I'm Right, the podcast that uncovers the origin stories of some of the biggest names in sports, media, entertainment, and so much more. Nick Durst here, along with Joe Calabrese. And Joe, our guest today, similar background as you with the writing stuff. I personally never would have the patience to do the writing, a very impatient guy, but you're very, very creative with the wordsmiths and whatnot. So let everybody know who is with us here today.
Yeah, you will certainly never be a doctor in life. He is currently Yahoo Sports' senior NBA reporter. He's worked at previous publications, including Sports Illustrated and Bleacher Report. He's a graduate of Northeastern, and he is the author of Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever, which was just published a couple of years ago. Get to pick his brain on the NBA and the state of where the league is at right now a little bit, which is nice. So we welcome Jake Fisher to the program. Jake, what's up, man? How you doing?
Doing well, guys. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Jake. So Joe mentioned it. You went to Northeastern. You studied journalism there. So going into the school there, what kind of was your plan as far as like, all right, what should I tackle here? And when I come out, is there a specific area you wanted to jump into, or did you kind of just fall into everything with basketball here? Were there any internships you did? What was your college experience like for you?
Yeah, you want the long answer, the short answer, or the medium answer?
The fun answer.
Let's go for the long answer.
Yeah, I mean, look, as like kind of ridiculous or cliche as it is to say, like what I went to school wanting to do is what I'm doing now. But it took like a lot of fortuitous bounces of the ball, if you will, for that all to happen. But I definitely got a really big head start on the industry, being that my high school newspaper, it's called Eastside from Cherry Hill High School East. It, to this day, from back when I was there, I graduated in 2012 through now, I think it's been an unblemished record of being awarded the best high school newspaper in the entire state of New Jersey. So I mentioned my book, like I dedicated Built to Lose to my third grade teacher who taught me how to write. And I also, my high school journalism advisor, Greg Gagliardi, who taught me how to report and taught all of us with that paper about news value and that stories are about people. And I really got to school with like a true idea of how storytelling and reporting worked. Not that I was any really good, but it helped me like really start to freelance and blog around the Sixers world and get to an internship at Slam Magazine the summer of 2013, which is basically when I kind of like really started covering the NBA, because it was when Sam Hinkie took over Philly, the 76ers, and he was very notorious for being secretive and not sharing any information about his pre-draft workouts and whatnot. And I was just this intern at Slam who had nothing to do. They stuck me in some back corner under an air conditioning unit and basically said, you know, figure out how to spend your time. And I started like tracking down information of agents and figuring out, you know, if a guy from Louisville is working, you know, leaks an agent of a player who's like the 70th ranked prospect who went to Louisville, leaks to some Louisville beat writer that, you know, Joe Schmo is working out with New York on Tuesday and Philly on Wednesday and Boston on Thursday. Well, after the Wednesday workout, I called that agent and say, who was at the workout? And I started kind of figuring out how the apparatus worked. And from there, I interned at Sports Illustrated 2 summers later. I was with the Boston Globe covering high school sports. So just kind of all stacked together. And by the time I got to Sports Illustrated the summer before my senior year of college, I was able to like do enough then that they gave me a freelance contract for after that. And I was covering Celtics games and the NCAA tournament down in Providence when Brandon Ingram was there with Duke, and just kind of kept building my Rolodex of contacts and like continuing to make every story be like the snowball into the next one. And if I got someone on the phone who went to Louisville, to keep using that example, you know, if I would think about any other possible connection to another story I'd want to work on in the future or something, and like bank basically 2 interviews in one, and kept always trying to figure out ways how to do that. So that's kind of the opening preamble.
I have some friends, they went to BU, right? So what was it like being accustomed to like the Jersey, Philly metro area? You know, I don't know how far up the turnpike you would come to the New York City area. But what was it like being around Boston, taking it in? It's a beautiful city, it's a clean city. A lot of people love it once they get there. They don't want to leave. So how was
Yeah.
Boston like?
Boston was great. And I think like the fact that Northeastern had this co-op program, like I went in fully committed to the career and like was around all these like-minded career focused people that like we were always bouncing ideas off of each other. And like my sophomore dorm felt like it was just me and these three other guys. Like I felt like we were in like a scene in a movie of like, you know, all these guys who were working on their things, you know, like it was definitely very, there was a lot of energy at that time, but like there were 70 something schools in Boston. So you would just, you know, by the time you're 21 and going to the bars, you just go to a house party off campus. Like you could just meet people from, you know, to this one area called Mission Hill that was, I guess it was west. I don't remember the directions of the city so well, but it was away from Copley Square, and maybe it was east. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. Just to get there, to get to these parties, get to where some of your friends live, like you would pass seven different schools. So it was, and it was interesting too. Also, to like, you know, I went to school in Boston. I'm from South Jersey, Philly area. Maybe I'm skipping ahead, but I live in New York now. I've lived here for the last 10 years, like. It helped also see the similarities, but also the differences in like, you know, Boston and Philly are supposed to be so different. Like we hate each other, but they're not. It's basically just different sides of the same coin. And it was I've always kind of been like a city person, I think, ever since I started dating a girl that went to BU before I was in college and like visiting there and taking the subway. Like to this day, I don't really like to drive. So the fact that I was in like truly in the city and not like at Tufts or something that was like, or Brandeis, not to besmirch those places, but like to be in the city and truly be like a city dweller and have your wits about you while you're walking on the street and stuff. To me, that just like got me where I needed to be.
Who would play you in your life movie about you and your biopic?
Man. I don't have a good. I feel like if I have a good answer, I'd make me a bona fide narcissist. But I don't know. So someone who,
I think there's an obvious answer. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but you guys strike
yeah.
the same resemblance.
Okay.
Scott Rogowski, former HQ trivia host. I think he'd be a
Oh,
slam dunk
okay.
lookalike there.
Yeah.
Same
We'll take it.
personality. I think it'd work.
Okay, we'll take it. We'll
What do you
take
think,
it.
Joe?
Absolutely. I see the resemblance. Scott's very funny. He's a good friend of ours.
Okay, very cool. I remember, I mean, when I first started at SI, I ended up like after school, the job they hired me for originally was to be this like breaking news writer person, kind of like an aggregation type news desk type. And they laid off the position before the job even started. So I was kind of without a job for like a couple of months and figuring it out. And like I moved to New York with some random gigs here and there. And then they basically offered me a part. It started out as a part-time night staff editor and then ended up being full-time. But I was on the night desk for like years. And I remember we were all doing that trivia like every night. Like the office would stop because I think there was two a day, right? There was like one in the
Yeah.
morning or one
Yeah.
at night. And whenever it was at night, like the office would shut down and everyone would just be on their phone and like basically trying to help each other answer it. And it was definitely like a moment for sure.
So you mentioned it before, your time at the Boston Globe. I want to talk about first getting the first job. Was it difficult coming out of college? And then your time working for Boston, the Boston Globe, and then SB Nation at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, all that stuff I was doing while I was in school, like there'd be so like I got the slam internship the summer after my freshman year, but during that freshman year, like through contacts and this blog I was doing, I ended up writing for the ESPN True Hoop site called Philadunkia. If people recall, ESPN.com had blogs for every single team And they would show up on the ESPN.com homepage. Like if you typed in ESPN.com/Sixers or whatever, like my stuff was there, which was pretty sweet. And you combine that with the reporting I was doing at Slam, like I knew Philadelphia was kind of like falling apart. And Liberty Nation, Liberty Ballers at SB Nation was like this rocket ship. And I made my way over there with, I don't even know how exactly it all came together, but I remember like talking on the phone with Michael Levin, who was running it at the time, who still does the rights to Ricky Sanchez with Spike Eskin. Shout out to those guys. And like them taking me on as like the reporter of the site. But I was going, I lived in Boston. Like I was going to, I mean, I would go to Celtics games with the Slam credential around my neck with any opportunity to write for Slam and to interview anyone who had done a 10-day contract with this, with the process Sixers and just like whatever, trying to kill as many birds with one stone, with one credential as possible. And that Glo the Globe was my first co-op after the Slam. And usually your co-op started, they were like the semester were broken into two summer semesters and a fall and a spring. And a co-op was either a spring co-op with that summer one attached at the end, or your summer two co-op with that fall semester attached at the end of that. And so most kids had like their freshman summer for fun. And I wanted to intern somewhere at Slam. So like that gave me a huge step up, I think, on getting the Boston Globe, high school sports stuff. And I was like the basketball writer. And I remember when I played high school basketball pretty competitively until I quit. I kind of really started doing this, honestly, because I recognized I wasn't gonna make the NBA. I mean, there was a while where I did think I had a chance to play in college, and it looked like I could have played D3, but I just like didn't. I knew I wanted to do this, and I wanted to really commit to it. The whole goal was like, I remember spending late nights at the Boston Globe working these desk shifts and thinking to myself, like I was working, answering the phones, take all these high school coaches, the second they get their book, they'd call in the score to the paper. I'd answer and write it down. And I'd hang up and I'd go back to transcribing some interview that I did in the locker room at TD Garden the night before, in between my homework and like pitching like the stories I would like if we had to write a profile for class on like someone in Boston, I would like do a someone with the Celtics and like submit it to my teacher to get graded, but also like try to pitch it freelance and get paid off of it. So I really was burning the candle at like both ends and on the side. And like once it was burnt, like waiting for the oil to like congeal again and burn, like I really was, I mean, I was just telling my partner the other night, like I asked her if she thought I worked hard, 'cause like I don't have the same level of energy that I did when I was 19, 21, 22, and I was working 20 hours a day. So some days I catch myself feeling like I'm not grinding. It's just like, it's just not, that wasn't practical. And that's what you have to do to make it, you know?
For sure. So, talked about earlier briefly, but you make the move to New York for a Sports Illustrated job that ends up not being there at first. I actually had the same experience happen to me. Not the moving part, but I got hired for Sports Illustrated and they canceled the job before I started. But
Oh man.
that was the jerk hiring
When was
manager.
that?
What was that?
When was that?
That was probably 2017.
Okay. That was with
Spring.
SI.com or the magazine?
It was for digital, so SI.com, yeah. So it was like
Yeah.
video, so they canceled it, and
Yeah.
wasn't too happy. But anyway, you end up getting in there finally. So what was it like working for Sports Illustrated, which when we were all kids, it was a really big deal. And then for
Yeah.
you there, you end up also doing some production work as like an associate producer. So for you, when you're doing that, or you're like, all right, this is interesting, or you're like, I really want to just stick to writing. What was your thought process during that time?
Yeah. I mean, so when I was interning there, it was pretty similar to that time at Slam, where like there really wasn't so much that, and I had to suspect that's really the case at like most internships, let alone media companies. Like most of the time, companies have a lot of these part-time and internship type roles just to kind of like check a box for like tax purposes or whatever. Like they don't have so much to do, or like it allows them to get young people in their door to maybe like look at them Oh, maybe a dime a dozen, we'll find someone. I don't really think there's like so much that is being asked of. So I was at SI, I was doing the same thing. I was reporting as much as I could, and I think I proved that I had these writing chops, and they wanted me writing for them afterwards. So when I got this only job was that associate producer night desk job, like I did what I had to do. I did tweeting and edit, like you had to tweet out like all the copy from, like I'd walk into that night shift and I get assigned NBA, NFL, and boxing. And I'd have to, like, if there was any news that came up, like I'd have to oversee the news coverage of that. And I'd have to facilitate our social media strategy. And sometimes if a writer filed from a game, like I would copy edit, I'd build a story in the backstage. I would write, I'd do every, like you literally would produce everything, and then you'd post it on social, post it on Facebook, post it on the web, like truly like navigating the actual website design. Did it all, but that started at 6 p.m. So during the day, I would go to shoot arounds. And there were even sometimes where I would get them to agree to like let me go, pretty typically the games that start in New York, the NBA games, the Nets and the Knicks games, pretty typically they start at 7:30, which means that the home team head coach talks at 5:45, the away team coach talks at 6, and the locker rooms are open from 6:15 to 6:45. And like that start of our shift from 6 to 6:45, you're coming in, you're getting, you're checking your email, you're getting adjusted. Like I didn't necessarily need to be there for that like opening hour. So sometimes I would get there at 7:15 after being in the locker room and start my shift. And then like most nights after the late game's over, like at midnight, it was last 2 hours, 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. There wasn't most nights there wasn't so much going on. So I was writing, man. And like I took a lot of pride in the fact that a lot of people in the industry, probably even to this day, like had no idea that I wasn't a staff writer at Sports Illustrated. Like that was always the goal. And when I was hired into that part-time, night desk role, I was basically told, like, keep doing what you're doing and you will be made a staff writer at some point. Well, that carrot was definitely dangled over my head for a long time, but like I still stand by doing, like, just like I tell college kids and anyone who's young in the industry, like all the time, one of the things I always say is like dress for the job you want, but like in a figurative sense. Like if you want to be a writer, but you're working at this great old media company, then write. I wasn't getting paid any extra for it, but every so often I pitch a story. They flew me to LA and I drove to the Ball's house in Chino Hills back during the draft, and I interviewed LeVar and Lonzo and LaMelo like pre-draft, and they sent me to Toronto to do a profile on Nick Nurse the year before they won the title, because someone at Summer League told me like, hey, it'd be a great story, Nick Nurse's nomadic journey, because how he got to this role, he's going to help the Raptors win a championship. And when they did, my story was in the commemorative magazine, like you see on TV, like Raptors fans, your team has won the title. So and then, I was building all these contacts and meeting all these people to the point where when I did get laid off, however many years later at, October 2019, like I was already kind of working on the book Built to Lose, and I had enough of a grasp on the NBA landscape that like I could still freelance and pitch articles and go. So it was great to do that at that company, and like to call someone and say you're from Sports Illustrated, that was a definite key to open a lot of doors. But yeah, I definitely did a lot of that on my own, and a lot of times had people trying to push me to not succeed. But I think that's just kind of how life works.
Joe, working 6 p.m. to 2 a.m., updating stuff on websites after midnight, remind you of anybody?
That reminds me of
Me.
I used to do some stuff for NHL.com. At the very
Yeah.
beginning, the first time around, I did a lot of copy editing and a lot of quick hits, like quick stuff that a lot of the other writers who were on site couldn't get to. And the second time around, it was a lot more media management, so a lot more video work. But eventually, two of those jobs ended up blending in together. So I did a lot of stuff, we'll say, for over the course of 4 to 5 years for NHL.com in two different stints.
Yeah,
Know
wow.
how that feels like.
Ever work with Mike Blinn?
I know who he is. Not directly though. No.
He was like my work husband on the night desk at SI. We A lot of long nights together, man. It was, I mean, just pouring your heart out to people and talking about how you're not getting where you want to go and all that stuff. He's great now. He's married, two kids. He's got her. He's doing good.
I'll tell you one thing, when you work in that type of environment, the editors that I've always worked with, and it's not just at that site as well, the editors I've always worked with have always run a very tight ship. So if I still do writing, or if I still oversee somebody else's writing or help somebody out, I have like a very strict, dry approach to when it comes to journalistic stuff like that. Are you any different?
Yeah, I think, I take the job very seriously, but I don't take myself so seriously, if that makes sense. At least I try not to. You want to get the names right, and you want to not have any mistakes, and you want like I value a deadline, and like if I tell someone I'm gonna give them 1800 words by this time, like it's not coming in at 2400 and it's not coming in 2 hours late. Like that definitely got, I mean, really ingrained in me when I was at the Globe. Like there was this editor named John Vitti. I'd go to the Globe and I'd sign out this like 1993 Jeep Grand Cherokee. It would be like, blah, 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 blah. Half the cars broke down half the time. But you'd go out to like Needham to watch some game and you'd drive over to a McDonald's where they had free Wi-Fi. You'd buy a soda and file the story, and you'd call John Vitti, and you would just be praying to God that this guy had no feedback for you. Because like, if you didn't cross off the who, what, where, when, and why within the first like two graphs, he just said, he tore it apart. So like, I definitely got taught a lot of those principles.
So let's talk about your time writing for Bleacher Report.
Yeah.
What were the biggest differences there working for them as opposed to a lot of your other previous stops? Because again, it's similar work, right? You built the Rolodex, you built the connections, you had
No.
a familiarity and experience, whether it was in the newsroom or being on site, covering and taking down everything. So what were the biggest differences there?
Yeah. At SI, all those contacts and stuff I was building, like I was writing these fun, wonky human interest stories. So I got to know all these people in the NBA because I was the only way that I've come to describe it was like I was writing these non-threatening things. So I was able every once in a while to write like, oh, inside this trade, because someone would just like tell me what happened, because it happened already, and like a week later I could put out this whole feature. Like I could cross circuit things and kind of piece together some stuff. And when I was freelancing for Bleacher Report after I got laid off, I wrote a couple of things like how this trade came together and blah blah blah. And so one day, it was like January 2021, my editor, Chris Trenchard, called me and said, "I got good news and bad news. The bad news is that we're cutting our freelance budget, but the good news is that we're creating this part-time position called a rumors reporter." And at the time, like I was really fully a freelancer. Like it took me a while to get on my feet, but I was kind of making it, man. And like I wasn't looking to be full-time anywhere, so it was kind of a perfect thing. But what they wanted me to do was at first was kind of like just get an anonymous executive to say something, and it'd just be like source colon this. And I kind of said to them like, I want to try a little bit harder and like dig a little bit deeper and like really try to do this. And I mean, it's definitely like been labeled as like being an insider. That role, I think, is like that word, I think, is a little loaded. But it's definitely what the track that they pushed me into. And so what happened was I called like 15 guys around the league, people who work for teams, and I said, "Hey, like they want me to do this. It's pretty good money from all things considered in this freelance budget that I got right now. Like, can I call you every week and pick your brain about things that are happening around the league?" And everyone said yes. And what you learn is like people from Golden State and Dallas and LA and Philly and Miami and Chicago, they're all super pumped to tell you about Boston, and those are just all right. Like the same thing applies to every other. So it was pretty, I think, quick to like get a pulse on what the people in the league are talking about. The next step is then to be able to like call the primary people involved and actually figure out what's going on and be able to report with authenticity and confirmation of like things that are going on behind the scenes. So it really was a true like blessing in disguise. Like at first, I really winced at it and didn't want to do it, but it was the greatest thing that ever happened to my life and career because it put me in this, quote unquote, insider position that like definitely brings much more profile and like benefits and the ability to like build a family one day.
Yeah.
So it was a pretty wild journey that was on for like 2 years, a year and a half. I basically was two like transaction cycles from the trade deadline to the free agency, trade deadline for agency. And then Yahoo came and approached me the summer of 2022.
Yeah, Bleacher Report. Some good people work there. I used to work there and used to work on these videos called the Insider Buzz videos, and I just go in there with the insiders like Rick Bucher or Matt Miller or Chris Sims, whatever, some other people my names were forgetting. They just record there. I'm hearing this, so that was all making a lot of sense to me what you're saying. But Yahoo Sports, I mean, they're big resurgence now, a great new leadership team there. Ryan Spoon, Sam Farber, and they're really bringing it back to making Yahoo prominent again here. So when they approach you with the offer, or you spoke with them, was it just kind of like an instant, like, all right, I like the vision here, I'm going to get to do what I want to do? And just how did that marriage come together?
So my Bleacher Report deal was up like that end of that summer of 22. I went to Summer League for Bleacher Report and like definitely working for Bleacher Report, but also with an ear to the ground for sure. I had a couple of meetings out there, but nothing really was like better than the situation I had. And I really did enjoy, like I was working with them and was contracted with them. And my editor, Chris Trenchard, who I mentioned, was like perfect partner. But I was still working for myself, which I really valued. Like I was starting to develop what I at the time was hoping to be my first novel that has now been buried away in a drawer somewhere. And like really had a bunch of, I put out a documentary short with BR, with God Sham God, and like was getting, trying to develop some things in the like feature realm and all that type of stuff. But then when I came, I remember I flew out of Vegas to Denver to see some friends, and I was literally writing and making calls in this park in Denver, like over some lake. I don't know what it's called. And I checked my email, and it was from Johnny Ludden, who Ryan and Sam hadn't come on at that point in time. But Johnny, I'd had some interactions with in the past when they were starting some other ideas and thought maybe I was going to be a good fit, and it fell short. So when he had a subject line that said like congrats or something, and it was like, you've done a really good job the last couple of years, we'd love to have a conversation. And I had a pretty good feeling from jump that based off the tone that they wanted me, which was really nice, obviously. And when we started getting on the phone, like it just really aligned that they basically wanted to marry the breaking news insider stuff, the trade deadline for agency, Intel notebooks that definitely are like the highest tracking stuff that I do. But they wanted me to figure out ways to add feature elements into that. And I've been able to, like, I did a profile on Jalen Johnson last week that like talked about why he fell in the draft and brought that type of, Intel type stuff mixed into a bigger feature. And like the Bucks basically were this close to signing Brook Lopez this summer, and if they did, I don't know if Alperen Sengun would have had the same breakout that he had. So like I asked Alperen Sengun all about that, like sliding doors moment. Like I've been able to kind of do that magazine style storytelling combined with the insidery intel stuff that really does sell. So that idea was really, really intriguing to me. And also, like, it's always been, I mean, Yahoo has always had a premier MBA team, where I always tell this story now. Like when I was interning at SI, like we talked about, it was 2015. I got an interview with Kristaps Porzingis at this restaurant called the Red Eye Grill on the west side of Manhattan. That, if you're a New Yorker, everyone has pretty much heard of that. And the PR guy for Kristaps's agency, who I'd worked with a lot previously, because again, like that was like my third year basically on the NBA beat already. I was only an intern, I was still in college, but like no one knew. I wouldn't tell anyone when I called. I'd just say, I'm with Sports Illustrated, I'm with Slam. Like no one knew I was this, like 19, 21 year old kid. I've always kind of looked older, so that helped a little bit too. But he said, come to Red Eye Grill. He has a sit-down interview and a lunch with this bit with like this national NBA writer, but you can get 20 minutes with him afterwards. So that writer at that time was Adrian Wojnarowski, who had the job that I have now. So that was only 7 years after later on. So it as much as like those long nights at night felt long, like it did happen pretty quick. And I think that like the ability, like the lineage of like Adrian to Shams to Chris Haynes, like it was something that I think added definitely like cachet, I think, to like if you're talking about keys to get indoors, like I definitely noticed people recognizing that the position I have is like the starting pitcher of, you know, like this team. Like, no, you're the ace of this team. Like, it definitely has a reputation of that. That, like, let's just be honest, has weight and helps you get work done. And that was appealing enough in itself. Yeah.
Awesome story. So, at which of your stops did you notice the most significant growth by your social media following?
Definitely Bleacher Report for sure. My book came out May 2021, and I think I had like 15,000 followers. And then by the end of that off season, I think I had like tripled it.
Wow.
Just because I remember I wrote this notebook. I remember when I was working on it in the back seat of a car with my brother and my cousin driving to the beach. Because like the draft ends Thursday night, free agency basically starts like Monday. That's pretty typically like Sunday afternoon. That's pretty typical of the flow of things. And I was working on a notebook that like basically said everything that was going to happen in free agency, which like of course none of these conversations can happen. So like how do I know the exact? So I was like painstaking overall, you know. This deal is likely going to be close to like I was hedging everything, not because I wasn't sure of it, because I didn't want to get anyone in trouble. And I remember I got a phone call from someone from the league office after I pressed. I sent the Google Doc first to a friend of mine in the industry. I was like, hey, is this okay? Because no one really wrote anything like that before. And he was like, you're gonna get in trouble. Like all these teams are gonna get flagged for tampering because of you. And I was like, but how? Like, there's no nothing in here says anyone's had any conversations. There's no whatever. I couched, like there were certain details that I got a little wrong. Like if I knew the deal was 4 years, 42, I would say 4 years, 40, or like in the ballpark of, you know, like intentionally, whatever. Remember, I got a call from someone in the league office after it published, thinking I was like fucked. And he just said, hey man, really good job. And I was like, okay, wow, like this is def like we're doing something here. And I remember there was like Reddit threads about like Jake Fisher pulled up from deep and like won free agency and blah 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 blah. That summer was definitely, I think, like a big changing point. And then I kind of carried that momentum through next spring. I was pretty ahead on the James Harden wanting out of Brooklyn. That helped a lot too, because it's James Harden. It was the starry Brooklyn Nets, and he wanted to go to Philly, and they had the whole Ben Simmons thing. And like it happened on the trade deadline, let's say it was like February 10th, like January 20th, I basically was the first person to write like James Harden wants out of Brooklyn and he wants to go to Philly. And I remember that like really took things up to another level. Yeah.
So let's formally reintroduce the title, Built to Lose. How's the NBA's tanking era changed the league forever? Now, this has been a point of emphasis in the NBA the last 10 to 15 years. Anybody who's ever followed a guy like Bill Simmons, who wrote the Book of Basketball and followed his time at Grantland and the Ringer, there's this idea that you don't want to be stuck in the middle, right? You're either a contender or you want to bottom out in order to try to give yourself a better opportunity in the draft to tr potentially land a franchise-changing player. So over the course of the time that you started writing in the book, right? So what did you kind of learn the most about the inner workings of these teams? And how long did it take you from start to finish, from the time that you had the initial idea to write the book until the final word before you sent the text in to the editing process, the publisher and all that? How long did it take you total?
I'd say probably like fall 2018 was when I first had the thought that like I'm at SI, I'm writing all this great stuff. My bosses are calling me into their office telling me like, wow, these ideas are so great. Like, where do you come up with them? And they weren't giving me the opportunity to keep writing those stories. So I kind of had the thought like I'm gonna make my own opportunity. So I was pitching stories for SI. Again, this is like similar thing that if people have been listening this long to like what I was doing back in college, right? Like I was pitching stories for SI that intentionally would get some character from the Sixers tanking years and what have you on the phone. But hey, by the way, I'm also kind of working on this book. So when I got laid off by October 2019, I had like 50, 60 interviews done already. So I was able to work on a proposal and like I spent probably that fall of 19 through the pandemic getting credentialed and going in the Nets. Shout out to Eli Perlstein and Aaron Harris, the Nets public relations department. Like they let me go to every game and just go into the visiting locker room. And I did so many interviews in the pregame locker room there, from like Aaron Gordon to like some 10-day contract guy who spent 30 days total in the league. And I think I really started putting pen to paper. I had to submit the manuscript June 30th, 2020. So when the pandemic happened, fortunately for me, obviously it was horrible and all the ramifications and what have you. Like it basically gave me a writer's retreat to have no excuse other than sit at this exact seat I'm talking to you guys from and write for 12 hours a day. Like I remember I would wake up and I'd do some home workout and I'd pretty much like sit down by noon and write till midnight with a couple breaks in between. And I got it done, I'd say probably in, yeah, like 3, 4 months actually, like with that. But that was a very like unreplicable situation, obviously. I mean, hopefully we never can replicate that again. But I was struggling to write it and where to start, because I collected information for 3 years and finally it was time to put pen to paper. You have, 700 hours of audio or whatever. I talked to over 300 people and I didn't know where to start, because at a certain point it evolved from just Philly to like all these other teams that were tanking. I was reading this book at the time called, I think it's called Levels of the Game by John McPhee. John McPhee is like truly one of my favorites. Nonfiction author. He wrote a great biography of Bill Bradley. And Levels of the Game, I think that's what the title is. It's in the other room. It's still like on like a display in my bookshelf in the living room. It was this book about Arthur Ashe and some other writer or some other tennis player, like Craig something. I'm not a tennis historian, but it was Arthur Ashe versus white tennis player and the polarities of their histories and their backgrounds and what have you across this net, but on the same court fighting for the same thing. And with each hit of the ball, he would unwind their story and then bring it back little by little, and then bring it back to the match and he hit it back to Arthur. And then Arthur would receive it. And as he's like winding back, it would talk about like, oh, this coach that taught him this and back when he was whatever. And it really showed me how to like tell a current event, like paced thing while also being able to wedge in reporting and storytelling into it. And I had a brain blast as I started reading that like the way to introduce this is the story started really at the 2013 NBA draft. Well, when every team's on the clock, oh, now this team's on the clock, who's making this pick? And that right there shaped my mind of like, my goal is to bring people inside the war room, to bring them on the phone between the agent and the general manager, and really bring this like behind the scenes, you know, bring people inside the locker room, on the team plane, in the film sessions. You know, I had this great scene in there where it's Summer League 2015, and the Kings coaching staff under Michael Malone, excuse me, he's now made it very clear he's Michael Malone. They've been thinking they're like going to get fired for like 18 months now. And George Karl has been the rumored name. They're out to lunch randomly at one spot on the Vegas Strip. As they're walking out, who walks in but Vivek Ranadive with George Karl? Like that type of stuff. I think, I mean, I really wanted to write a narrative nonfiction. I didn't want to write just like, here's what happened. I wanted to tell a story. I wanted to bring characters to life. I wanted it to feel like you were in the room with all these characters. So that's kind of that whole answer.
Awesome. Yeah, definitely a big process, for sure. And all things considered, from the idea to the published date, not that long really when you think about it. So we'll see, Jake. Maybe another book in your future will be. I'm sure you're already brainstorming things. You don't got to give us any details, but curious with your role now, obviously, breaking news is involved, but so is the long form stuff. So when you're getting the scoop on something that might be happening, how are you deciphering whether or not do I go to my editor and put this on the website versus I need to tweet this out right away?
Yeah, I think for me, if anyone follows my work pretty closely, you're probably like familiar that I'm not on Twitter all day, every day. I may always make fun of my co-host Dan Devine or podcast No Cap Room on the Ball Don't Lie overall podcast feed because he's tweeted like over 200,000 times. And when I was younger and like trying to make it, I definitely felt this pull, like a regressive pull to be performing on there. So like in general, I felt it was like better for me to like not try to, like even the other day I had a thought, I was like, oh, I'll tweet this out. And I was like, well, I could also just go on with my day. And that I think has helped shape my mindset of, and I don't say that to say like I'm better, I'm like above that. I like it's healthier for me to not be thinking every time I take a bite into the sandwich, like, should I tweet about it? You know what I mean? Because especially when I was in that freelance space, and even now, like, I'm an employee of a company, but my job is essentially like me and who I am. And the blurring of like the professional entity of you and like your personal life is pretty hard to find where that line is sometimes. So I've tried really hard to like keep that line as bold as possible. A big way to do that is just like tweet only when I have something that is news, which my goal is with that perspective. Like I work for Yahoo, I don't work for Twitter. So I am trying to always save as much as I can for the website. But when like it's the day of the trade deadline, like I'm just moving as quick as I can. And when it's the day, when it's draft night, like I remember this draft kind of hearing through the industry that like ESPN reporters were not going to be tipping picks because it's their broadcast. It happened in the NFL. I was like, oh, at least it opened a pretty good opportunity for me. And like, I don't necessarily think it really adds so much value to tweet out 3 minutes before you see it on your TV broadcast that the Pacers are trading down, with, or that the Pacers are trading down with Washington so that the Wizards can get Bilal Coulibaly, not the Pacers can draft Jairus Walker. But for me, when I was getting first on picks at 7, 8, 9 trades that were happening, team people who were at 15, 16, 17 in their war room started reaching out to me, being like, hey, what's happening? And I started to get a flood. So it definitely, there is some type of like performative nature, not even really for the public, but for the actual like fraternity of people in the NBA to showcase that you know some things so that people will start to. I mean, I've tweeted out some things the day of the trade deadline, and like 2 seconds later, I get a call from a GM being like, is that actually happening? Because we're working on this. Like, because the goal really is to be collaborative to a certain extent. Like, if I can help a team get something done, they're going to give me something back that can help me get my stuff done. So, that's pretty much my gauge.
Awesome. Great insight there. Appreciate that. For you, what are your favorite arenas to cover a game as a credentialed member? What factors go into making your favorite? Is it, where you're sitting during the game, your access to the players, and I guess more importantly, the food they give you and the access to a bathroom? Is it a private bathroom or whatnot? So which arenas are your favorite?
Man, there's all these little things. Like, it's really not the food. Like, it's I'm fortunate enough that, like, most of the time when I'm at a game too, like, it's getting expensed if it costs money. You know what I mean? So, like, I do care about, like, is there a private elevator up to, like, the media seat, or like a private stairwell at least? Like, do I have a good view of the court? Is it too close to the fan section that, like, yells and stands all game long? Is the Wi-Fi good? That type of stuff. I mean, if you want to go like whole nine yards, like, is the PR staff accessible? Do the players have some giant gym next to the locker room so they're all lifting when we have our access time so they're not there? Is the security staff nice and friendly? Like, I was just in Miami last week. It was the first time I actually went to a Heat game as a credentialed reporter, and, like, never been there before. Every single person I asked an arena worker a question, they were so kind and, like, help point whatever. But sometimes, you show up to Oklahoma City for a shoot around on a Wednesday morning, and they don't know the Miami Heat are there, and, like, there's no PR con, and you're, like, begging and bartering for some 71-year-old retired librarian who just does this in her free time to, like, let you into the building. So that stuff gets pretty tough. But I think, I mean, it's like a place that, like, is near and dear to my heart because of where I, like, started. Like, TD Garden's always been great. Plenty of, like, behind the scenes bathrooms and elevator stuff and what have you. Philly feels like home because I definitely grew up going to those games. And I just it is very it's old it's an older arena, but it's, like, very navigable. Like, it feels very intuitive to me. And Barclays, I do love to be at, just because it's in the borough, and the people there are good to me, and I like the arena. Like, it just has, like, a fun energy to it. But Sacramento, I'll say, has, like, the best game day experience, from the light, the beam, to all the stuff they got, to the PR staff is great. The players, I think, when I was there last fall, were just, like, happy to be part of something that's, like, turning the corner and having momentum. And it was cool that, like, a national writer was there to pay attention to that. Like, I enjoyed Sacramento, and, like, I'm looking forward to the next time I get to go back there.
Could be sooner than you think. You never know what's going to happen in the playoffs. And yeah,
Yeah.
Barclays, Joe and I actually had the chance this past summer to cover some New York Liberty games. And so it's pretty easy to move around underground there underneath. And it was a good experience over there for sure. But Jake, for you in your life for your career, what would you say is your right moment? What I mean by that, it's a time or place where you wanted to pursue something. You asked somebody for advice and they told you, Jake, that's a bad idea. Don't do that. Not going to work out. And you were like, you know what? I'm going to do it anyway. And in the end, you'll see why it is that I'm right.
And I remember where I was. I was working from home. It was a Tuesday night, that October 2019, when, like, the New York Post or something broke that Chris Stone, who was the executive editor of Sports Illustrated at the time, was, like, parting ways, or whatever the bullshit language they used, and, like, more layoffs were expected to come. And I just kind of knew right then and there that I was going to get let go. And I felt, like, very prepared. Like, I had several opportunities to leave that I just turned down for various reasons over the years before they let me go. Like, I didn't want to leave New York, what have you, other things. And I also like had this inherent belief that like I was going to be at some point awarded a staff writer role that never came. But I remember it wasn't just that first moment of like being on the phone with a friend and being like, I'm ready. Like, let's do it. Like, I'm ready for the safety net to be gone. It was such a profound like 72 hours after what happened, because it was like pretty big national. It was like right before, I mean, pre-pandemic, like layoffs weren't so widespread across the industry. Of course, they were happening, but like at ESPN and at the like, it became kind of like we were the first one that, and it was this print legacy institution that like was too big to fail, and it did. And it was like the death, this it was this huge national story. So all these people were, I was getting on the phone. I mean, I remember thinking, like, regretting, I should have done a podcast series of just like me, like 10 episodes of phone calls with me smoking and talking to my people, like just figuring out what to do. Because they were just like really profound moments in my life of like all these people encouraging me certain things. And this documentary producer who I worked on that Sham God doc with basically said to me, you don't need to work for anyone ever again. Like, just make a LLC, make a production company, and the business can just be works of authorship by Jake Fisher. And like, you're gonna be fine. And when he said that, it just like affirmed everything that I had done to that point. And to this day, like, I still identify, like, no, like, it will be fine. That's a very privileged position to be in for sure. But like definitely worked for that for sure. And I like that really was a big turning point, I think. I mean, it took me a long time to like truly be fine. Like, I definitely had to ask my parents for some help at a certain point before like I turned the corner, but like I gave that money back. You know what I mean? Like, so it definitely had a lot of advantages and a lot of help, but like being let go, I guess I was still 25 at the time, and like feeling so unfulfilled at that place, and like knowing I was supposed to be feeling lost, and like, what am I gonna do? And this person, but like also, but like thinking inherently from the very beginning, like, I'm ready for this. And someone who I respected who was already doing it, saying, like, yeah, you're fine. Like, you just need to do this for tax purposes, and it's gonna be better, and you're gonna be great. That was like a pretty rewarding moment.
Every little thing is going to be all right. Jake, we thank you for your time. We really appreciate it. Last question from me. Where does LeBron end up next year?
That's a
He's
good
coming to the
question.
Knicks, right? If they fail this year and they come up short, right? He's the missing piece.
Anything's possible, man. At this point, I'd be
Listen,
shocked.
Messier won here in 94, and he's legendary with the Rangers. Could be
True.
the
That's
same
true.
thing all over again with the Knicks.
LeBron will go where his son goes. That's my thought process.
Because
Right.
at this point,
Whoever takes Bronny in the second round, right?
yeah, at this point, if it's not the Lakers or a team that has Bronny, I would be surprised. But as I've learned, as I say all the time, this shit can change in 2 seconds, man. So to make a prediction about what's going to happen in July and March is very precarious territory that I try not to wade too deep into.
Jake, you think we're going to see LeBron and Steph Curry in Paris this summer for Team USA?
Oh yeah, those two guys, Kevin Durant, definitely a part of it. We'll see what other people come in. I mean, Kawhi was like supposed to, but I mean, a lot of this stuff is also going to be dependent on like how deep these guys go in the playoffs. Joel Embiid
Well,
was
with
supposed to
Kawhi,
play.
he might take the playoffs off to rest up for the Olympics. You know, that's kind of his MO. He's always take it off to rest up for the next season. But I think the Team USA is going to be back in a big way this year. I think LeBron, he's all in. It's his last chance for the Olympics and finally see some stars back in the Olympics.
There you go, man. It should be a really fun time in July in Paris.
Did you any chance you'll be there?
I will not be there. I will not be there. Just learned that a little while ago. I had a great privilege to go cover the World Cup at Manila, or in Manila, in the Philippines last summer, which was awesome. And I think I'm on the World Cup beat, which happens every 4 years in its own. But yeah, the Olympics were just another beast. And I will be grateful for some time away. I'll say that. But if the time comes again where the Olympics are there and Yahoo or someone else wants.
2028 Los Angeles. I mean, I think that's a good shot for all the media to be out
Yeah,
there.
maybe we'll make that happen. Yeah.
I absolutely love that. Yeah, no, I agree with Nick. I think that it's a certain reputation thing, and not to make light of it, but Kobe always took the Olympics seriously. He took everything in his life seriously. So I think that's added motivation for the stars who still exist, like the Steph Currys and LeBrons and Durants of the world. But yeah, no, I think everybody's going to be super motivated this summer. It's going to be a great thing for the NBA again, having all the big stars there and kind of going full throttle with it. But Jake, again, we thank you for your time. We appreciate it. If there's anything else you would like to share or promote, by all means, go ahead. We thank you for your time, and this is really
Yeah.
great.
Thank you guys for having me. Yeah, keep it locked on yahoosports.com and our NBA coverage from myself, Dan Devine, Vinny Goodwill, Ben Rohrbach, Kristen Peek. We just brought on Tom Haverstraw in a contributor role. I really do think we've got some of the best stuff out there. Our podcast, Ball Don't Lie, it's got shows from Vinny Goodwill twice a week. It's got Dan's own show, Diviner Intervention. Dan and I bring you No Cap Room every Thursday. And yeah, that book, Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era, is still available for purchase and royalties still are good. And it's like, it's truly like a work of like, that was something, if you listen to this, like I poured myself into that to like help put myself in the position I'm in now. And like, definitely made that all from scratch and no one gave any of that to me. So it's a true labor of love that like I knew people were going to have to pay for to read. So I say that to say like I promise you it will be worthwhile, especially being that it's like incredibly heavily discounted anywhere on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, wherever. So check it out. Yeah.
All right, Jake, we appreciate your time. Congratulations on your success so far. Continued success to you moving forward here. And that's going to do it here for this episode of You Know I'm Right for our very special guest, Jake Fisher, my co-host, Joe Calabrese. I'm Nick Durst, and this has been You Know I'm Right.